Iran has issued a warning about Israel's nuclear arsenal, in particular its nuclear warheads, which is estimated to number between 200 to 400. This is while Israel has not only been claiming that Iran is just a short time away from obtaining the bomb, it has also threatened Iran with military action. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how it is that Israel and not Iran, who is a threat not only to the Islamic Republic, but also to the West Asia region as a whole. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille, France. Also joining us, former U.S. government advisor Paul Larudi, who joins us from Berkeley.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Paul Larudi, I'm going to first start with you. I'm curious as to why Israel is pursuing a policy of what they call deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, when it is very well known that it does possess between 200 to 400 of them, warheads in particular. Not only the former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said that, but you also have that whistleblower Vanunu who has claimed that. But why does it pursue this policy of what it calls nuclear ambiguity?
There's a very simple answer to that, and that is that the U.S. Congress has passed, the U.S. government has passed legislation saying that the U.S. cannot provide aid of any kind to any country that possesses nuclear weapons and develops nuclear weapons. Therefore, since this is an agreement between Israel and the United States, and the State Department of the United States every year certifies that they have no evidence that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, in which case it is permissible to provide Israel with aid. That's the bottom line. There are other reasons that Israel considers it advantageous, but this is the main one that began decades ago.
Like, what are the reasons that it does not want to claim that you said are advantageous for not stating it?
Well, they can't be held in non-compliance with various international treaties if they don't belong to those treaties, and if they supposedly don't have nuclear weapons, and they can't be held accountable, I think, on a variety of metrics, means of judging them. They can't be held accountable if it's not certain that they have these weapons.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, so we have what Iran has stated, and many are also questioning as to why you have the NPT, and when you have the threat that are posed by nuclear weapons, that Israel, which again, even though they don't want to admit it, but have 200 to 400 of these nuclear warheads, are not a member of the NPT. Iran says it should be a member of the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And the big question is, why isn't the IAEA actually fulfilling its responsibility in this regard to pursue this matter with Israel? Of course, Iran is saying that because it's also being threatened by Israel militarily, but above and beyond that, Israel keeps accusing Iran of pursuing a path towards weaponizing its nuclear program.
Thank you for having me. The answer is quite simple. The IAEA was formed in 1957 by the Americans. And since the 1957, the Israelis were engaged at the beginning with building a nuclear reactor with the help of France, Norway, and the Americans. And since then, the IAEA never inspected the Israeli nuclear plant. It was only later when Ben-Gurion admitted that the Dimona was hosting what used to be a textile factory, in fact, was a nuclear reactor. And the reason why the Israelis said for the first time, we're talking about in 1962, 1963, when they admitted the first time that they may have developed a nuclear weapons in their what used to be called textile factory, only deterrent to Arab actions against Israel. So since then, the Americans have created the Atom for Peace program at the time of President Eisenhower and camouflaged the Israeli reactor and the Israeli development of nuclear weapons. It was since then that the Americans planned to hide what the Israelis are doing to prevent the IAEA that was formed by the Americans to go and inspect what the Israelis have and to make sure that the public and the world is aware of the Israeli nuclear capability. Instead, they've hidden all that. The French has hidden all that. Norway hidden all that. And they all aware, the international community is aware, because they have, Norway provided 20 tons of water for the reactor, and France provided the reactor. So they all know what's happening in Israel. They all know about the weapon that Israel have. And also, we know that the Israelis were about to use nuclear weapon during the 6 days war with the Arabs. So now, failing to expose all that and to open the site to international community and international supervision, it shows us first that international supervision is not international, but is under the thumb of the Americans. Second, that everything the Israelis are doing is covered and supported by the Americans. Third, it's a cherry picking for the Americans to go and accuse Iran and Korea and China and the countries that are not friendly to the U.S. and push the IAEA to go inspect what they are doing with the nuclear reactor, if it is for peace or for weapon purposes.
Well, one of the things that happens when you have a nuclear reactor is the fact that it poses a threat or a danger to the environment, Paula Rudy. And given the fact that it's not under the IAEA supervision, as we understand, that this in particular obviously provides a threat to the West Bank. You have nuclear waste that it is alleged that the Israel is burying in the West Bank. Shouldn't that be a matter of concern?
Of course it's a matter of concern, especially to the Palestinians themselves. But this is, again, nothing new. Israel has used the occupied territories as a dumping ground for all sorts of toxic waste and materials. And so they consider this a way of continuing the genocide of the Palestinians, destroying the Palestinian people, at least those that are, well, in general, the Palestinian people, both those who are under their direct rule and those that are not, even outside. They've done similar things in Lebanon, for example, and Syria and so forth. They consider it an advantage to be able to put toxic materials where they want to make life miserable, difficult, and even to end life for the people that they want to get rid of. So this is just part of their policy of genocide.
You had an idea that came up during the former president, Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Elijah Magnier, and that was a West Asia or Middle East free zone. as he called it during that time. And just recently, again, Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN has drawn attention to this establishment of a zone free of WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, of which it was actually initiated by Iran at the UN. Israel is against that. It does not want that. Coming from Iran and the fact that Israel does not want that, what message is that sending?
Iran is sending a message that the Middle East, as the rest of the world, should be free of weapons of mass destruction. However, this is not what the Americans want. So if we look at all the American administrations, starting from Eisenhower to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon, they all hide and hid all the Israeli capability for one purpose, is to keep a deterrence in the Middle East against the U.S. allies, against the U.S. enemies. So when Iran is coming out with a proposal saying we want the Middle East without weapons of mass destruction, is really targeting only Israel because it's the only place where there are weapons of mass destruction. And this is goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that want Israel to remain as the policeman of the region, which is not something that Iran accepts. And also all the country where there is a population that stands against the normalization with Israel and refuse what the Israeli did by taking occupying the Palestinian territory. So by Iran saying, I want this, a Middle East or an area or half of the world or whatever, free of weapons of mass destruction, it goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that the U.S. will certainly refuse to abide by and would completely ignore the call for a weapons of mass destruction, which is obviously that is directed only toward Israel. And the Americans are not ready to compromise anything, what they call the security of the Israelis.
Paula Rudy, I think you also had a response to that.
Mr. Manier is exactly correct. And the United States does not want to give up an advantage or the advantage of its ally, or Israel is just basically an extension of the United States, or you could say the United States is an extension of Israel, if you like. They have an advantage, which are the nuclear weapons, and they can always threaten others with them and cause problems, as we've already discussed. So this is they want to keep that advantage, and the idea of a nuclear-free or a nuclear weapons-free Middle East is they're not willing to consider it, and they don't have to. Because they're the power in the region.
But when you take a look at Israel, Elijah Magnier, Israel is the only entity right now that is not only attacking a sovereign nation repeatedly, namely Syria. It has actually attacked Syria's nuclear facilities at one point, in order to, based on its views, to stop the further investment of its nuclear program. At the same time, it is threatening Iran militarily. So when you have an entity that is reacting that way and carries out operations like that, military operations, isn't then Israel at the highest risk of proliferation or using nuclear weapons?
Indeed, it is. Israel did not attack Syria's side only. It has attacked also Iraq in the 80s. To stop Iraq from developing its nuclear capability. So any country that stands as strong in competition with Israel, Israel reacts to it with the full support of the United States of America. Now, Israel represents a danger because the Israelis are really looking to attack any country that for them can create a threat to Israel. Now, the only threat in the region is Israel itself. To violate the Lebanese air space, to violate Syrian airspace to bomb Lebanon, to bomb Syria, to bomb Iraq. They bombed many sites of the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Iraqi security forces, attacks in Iran and assassination. So it's Israel that is taking always initiative and is the first aggressor. Now, as long as it has what Israel called a deterrence, a nuclear deterrence, at the end of the day, I don't think this is a point of strength for Israel, because we've seen how Russia in Ukraine was not able to use its nuclear weapons. However, that doesn't justify that Israel needs to go unchecked and for the world to keep looking the other way about what the Israelis are doing and what are their nuclearity is in the Negev and the Dimona and what they are doing there and how they are developing, and if that represents a danger to the civilian population.
Well, you have obviously one of the most important standoffs that can occur because of the way that Israel acts, and that is when it comes to Iran. We have seen what Israel has done in terms of acts of sabotage against Iran, from the assassinations of a number of nuclear scientists to facilities itself, which the most recent one was in Karaj. And one of the most recent developments also was how an Israeli spy cell was actually caught. And one of the revelations was that they wanted to lay bombs at a sensitive site in Esfahan, which, according to one report, they had already gone through and done that. So aren't these all signs that there needs to be some restriction, some oversight, then, back to the question, through the relevant organization, which at this point is the IAEA, in order to stop anything from happening?
Well, neither the IAEA nor the United Nations nor any other organization is going to stop Israel from doing whatever it feels like doing, as long as it feels that it has the power to do it without consequences to itself. And that's unfortunately the situation, and it's the situation of its sponsor, the United States as well. It will, both entities will do whatever they can to make others subservient to them and to enhance their control of various parts of the world, the population, the economy, the territory. We can talk about what the law says and what morality says and all of these things, but in the end, it is strength that talks. It is power that talks, and Israel is going to use whatever power it has in order to cause disaster for its neighbors, to keep its neighbors in check, and also to use its power to enhance, to enlarge its territory and increase its own power over its neighbors. And that's the same applies to the United States, which, as I said before, is just one is the extension of the other.
Well, Elijah Magner, Israel has sounded the alarm over Iran on so many occasions when it comes to its civilian nuclear program. A quick question that comes about during these times, where we're looking at the revival of the JCPOA, if there's even a point of saying the revival if it's not dead yet, is why doesn't the U.S. just make the political decision to get back into the deal that the U.S. pulled out from in the first place, in order to, in their eyes, eliminate any chances that there may be, in their eyes again, for Iran to pursue any type of weaponization of their program, which will then, by default, leave only Israel with nuclear weapons in West Asia?
Because when you give the Americans a finger, they won't come. The problem is Iran is negotiating the Americans in good faith, but the Americans and the Europeans are in the POA. In 2018, one is the American, Donald Trump, just threw away the JCPOA, and the Europeans find themselves withdrawing from Iran and not abiding by their signature. So you are dealing with Western organizations that just want to impose their will and dominate whoever country that is ready to be dominated, Iran is not on the list of dominated countries for the West. And by showing its rejection of the U.S. supremacy and the U.S. control and hegemony, Iran became the enemy. So whatever Iran is doing and offering, the Americans are trying to have a deal where they keep having the upper hand over the Iranians. And Iran is trying to say that we want a deal where we are both equal, where this is the big mistake Iran is doing, because the Americans are not interested in becoming an equal partner in this deal, because they are not a viable partner. They want the upper hand, and they want to make sure that they can return to the sanctions against Iran, because you are dealing with Western, not international organization like the IAEA, that brings out of the hat all the rabbits they want against Iran whenever they want, because they are pushed by the United States. And then you negotiate the peace, a deal that the JCPOA is saying, I agree to control my nuclear program that is weapon-free. And they say, no, but we want to impose sanctions on your institutions, because whenever we want, we can cripple your economy. So you are both talking different languages, and it is like you don't understand each other, because the American side is not ready to sit on the table as an equal partner. The Americans want the upper hand. That is the point.
Okay, we got about 30 seconds to give to you, Paula Rudy. You had a statement coming out from the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, that was interesting, that said Iran can transform itself into a nuclear power and it's too late to stop it by surgical attack. Of course, he goes on to say, again, talk about the timeline here, that it will take Iran 18 to 24 months in order to reach that, what did he call it, treating metal uranium and picking it. Well, he talked technically there. You know, you have the threat, and then, but it takes a couple of years, even though the threat is going to take a couple of weeks. Never understood how they always talk about weeks away, and we can go back to 20 years ago up to now. Anyways, what is interesting about this is the fact that you have Israel, who is very much against this JCPOA revival. Why would Israel really be against this if it feels threatened in any shape or form? By Iran pursuing, again, in its eyes, a nuclear weaponization program?
Well, the answer is that Israel does not feel threatened by it, and it considers that it can take whatever measures it needs in order to remain more powerful, especially in terms of nuclear weapons. It's not really afraid of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, most of all because of the policies of the government. The government of Iran has said repeatedly that it has no interest in acquiring nuclear weapons and is not pursuing any nuclear weapons. So this, well, I think this is not an issue.
Thank you very much for that. Paul Rudy there, former U.S. government advisor. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Both of you, thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds. that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Qala kalla fadhhaba biayatina inna ma'akum mustami'un.
Allah said, "No, go both of you with our signs. Indeed, we are with you, listening."
فَأْتِيَا فِرْعَوْنَ فَقُولَا إِنَّا رَسُولُ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ.
Go to Pharaoh and say, "We are the messengers of the Lord of the worlds."
So as you have been previously with us, brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 15th verse of chapter Shu'ara, where the Almighty Allah says, "Inna ma'akum mustami'un." We are with you listening. The 16th verse says, "Fa'tiya fir'aun faqula inna rasulu rabbil alamin." So go to Pharaoh and say, "Verily we too are the messengers of the Lord of the worlds." In the previous verses, the first phase of Moses' mission was stated. He received this revelation and asked the means of achieving this great aim. Now, it is the second phase. It is time to meet Pharaoh, and they are going to have a critical conversation with him, the Pharaoh, and this is what mentioned in this verse. As an introduction, Allah points to the availability of everything for Moses and Aaron, and that's why he commands them and says, "So go to Pharaoh and say, verily we too are the messengers of the Lord of the world." فَأْتِيَا فِرْعَوْنَ فَقُولَا إِنَّا رَسُولُ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. The Quranic phrase فَأْتِيَا, come together, shows that they must speak with Pharaoh himself at any price. One point that might come to your minds is that the word Rasul, or the messenger, has been used in its singular form, although they were two, فَأْتِيَا فِرْعَوْنَ فَقُولَا إِنَّا رَسُولٌ. Go to Pharaoh, you two, and say, "We two are the messenger." This does not seem right, but this might refer to unity and oneness of their call, as if they were two souls in one body, with one program, with one aim. So that is why they said, فَقُولَا إِنَّا رَسُولٌ رب العالمين. We are the messenger.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, We will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, up to this part of the story of Prophet Moses, it was revealed to him that he has this responsibility, and upon receiving this revelation and responsibility, he stated that he is going to face some problems in achieving the great mission of the Almighty Allah. But whatever he stated was for the sake of achieving this great aim, and it was not that he is feared of his life. Responding to that, Allah said, "Inna ma'akum." Allah sympathizes with him and removes their worries, relieves him so he can go to Pharaoh. He orders him to go to Pharaoh, فَذْهَبَ إِلَى فِرْعَوْنَ. So Allah tells him not to worry about the superficial powers of Pharaoh, and interestingly, orders him to go to the origin of these cruelties. You have to fight corruption at its root, and it is only Fir'aun. فَأْتِيَ فِرْعَوْنَ. You need to go to Pharaoh and speak with him, himself, at any price. Another point, brothers and sisters, which is notable, is that they introduce themselves, they have to introduce themselves by saying, "Inna Rasulu Rabbil Alameen." We are the messenger of the Lord of the worlds. In doing your missions, in inviting the people to truth and monotheism, you have to be clear, definite, and explicit. You introduce yourself and you somehow connect yourself to the Lord of the worlds. That Lord has everything in its control. And this is a very interesting point. You are facing someone who claims and says, "Ana Rabbukumul A'la," and in response to that, you have to introduce the Lord of the worlds, that great Lord, which is not just the Lord of this world, but also the Lord of the two worlds. He is the absolute cause. And that's why they introduce themselves referring to the Lord of the worlds. Inna Rasulu Rabbil Alameen. Brothers and sisters, thank you for staying with us in this episode of the program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
In a major blow to freedom of the press, the European Union's second highest court has upheld the ban on Russian media outlet RT France for alleged disinformation. Launched in 2017 with a 20 million euro budget and well over 100 employees, RT France burst onto the scene with reporting that the billionaire-dominated French mainstream media refused to touch. Their coverage of the Yellow Vest social revolt won widespread praise. They rejected the total Western media blackout on the movement, which began in June 2019.
Providing news is a public service and an obligation of every state. Therefore, it is entirely legitimate for a state to contribute to the budget of medias so that their citizens have balanced, objective information according to their own point of view.
It was no surprise that President Emmanuel Macron was the first leader to call for a Europe-wide ban on Russian state media. The French government then orchestrated the rapid implementation of the ban less than a week after Russia started its military operation in Ukraine.
It's dramatic when you ban alternative news sources, which haven't even broken any laws. There has been no slander or racism or calls for violence, and yet they're denied freedom of expression. It's a dramatic problem for France and Europe, and compounded by the fact that there is absolutely no alternative point of view permitted or available in French media.
The fact that freedom of the press is granted to far-right media, such as the Islamophobic Charlie Hebdo magazine, but denied to the Russian people, has already left its impression. The citizens of France and Europe have not been allowed to hear both sides of the long-running conflict in Ukraine. This one-sided media domination has allowed European elite to whip up Russophobia and war hysteria unopposed and provided them with the opportunity to impose unprecedented economic and diplomatic pressure on Moscow. Upon relinquishing the EU's rotating presidency in June, Macron was criticized for saying that the unrest in Ukraine accelerated the bloc's collective agenda. The EU was criticized for once again relying on not democratic means to achieve political ends. A final appeal by RT France to the European Court of Justice is expected to fail as well. In 2012, on the orders of the European Commission, Press TV was removed by top European satellite provider Eutelsat. Last year, the PressTV.com domain was seized and shut down by the United States federal government. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A new study has revealed a shocking disparity by British schools, which have gone to great lengths to promote Ukraine solidarity among their students, in stark contrast to how Palestinian solidarity is suppressed in the classroom. Human rights group CAGE carried out the survey, which received 532 responses from parents, students, and teachers. The group said the survey revealed a cavalier attitude to due diligence, including collaboration with organizations with far-right links and the soft penetration of security think tanks and those linked to the UK's so-called Prevent Counter-Extremism program. Some of the survey's findings include 96% of respondents confirming proactive engagement on the Ukraine issue by their school, including holding non-uniform days, activities, or donation appeals. 62% indicated their school had fundraised or hosted donation drives for Ukraine, while 17% also mentioned schools promote the Ukraine flag, such as hoisting the Ukrainian flag on school grounds. And perhaps most shockingly, alleged funding from some schools was intended to provide military gear for the war. In 2021, Israel's bombing of Gaza drew huge international backlash as millions took to the streets worldwide. British students also joined the outpouring of support for Palestine. However, British schools responded negatively, with students being punished for waving a Palestinian flag or branded racist in some cases for expressing solidarity.
For Palestine, supporting Palestine goes against British foreign policy interests. Support for Ukraine is in line with that, and hence that was allowed and encouraged, and the government even produced guidance for schools and for parents into how they could do so. While for Palestine, the government minister for education at the time, Gavin Williamson, he issued a letter, clear letter to schools, indicating to them that discussion on Palestine needs to be clamped down or managed to such a degree where it can only ever amplify the pro-Israeli, pro-apartheid narrative.
In early July, London's High Court dismissed a legal challenge by CAGE against the Department for Education over issuing so-called discriminatory guidance, which was then used by schools to censor and penalise any student who was willing to express solidarity with Palestine, particularly during Israel's bombardment of Gaza last year. This whole saga will have convinced many more that Britain may indeed be biased when looking at conflicts and human rights abuses abroad. Robert Carter, London.
France continues to be at the forefront of the West's effort to whitewash Saudi autocrat Mohammed bin Salman, who even Western leaders believe was behind the brutal murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. After the murder, French President Emmanuel Macron was the first Western leader to visit the House of Saud last December, and now he has rolled out the red carpet for the Crown Prince's first visit to Europe. Human rights groups and leftist politicians strongly criticized Macron's decision, just as they criticized his legitimizing embrace in 2020 of Libyan warlord Khalifa Haftar and Egyptian military dictator Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, as well as Macron's enormous arms sales to Arab monarchs for their brutal war against Yemen. Already tenuous claims to support human rights in the Middle East have become increasingly irrelevant to Western leaders as their sanctions campaign against Russia has dramatically backfired against their own economies. Energy prices have soared in Europe, causing record inflation, and energy outages loom this winter.
At the beginning of the year, France's annual economic growth rate was expected to be 4%. The government has already slashed that prediction almost in half, and it could fall even further.
The great revolution linked to Ukraine and the Russian sanctions is that if you're a purchaser of oil instead of a producer of oil, then you're going to view bilateral relations in a strictly economic manner in order to ensure your future supplies. This is going to change relations with many countries, such as Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Algeria, the UAE, and others.
Just a week ago, Macron received the head of the United Arab Emirates, signing a strategic agreement to cooperate in the energy sector. The Paris visit by the de facto Saudi ruler comes 2 weeks after a visit to Riyadh by United States President Joe Biden, who backtracked on his promise to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state because of the Khashoggi murder.
When it comes to the level of output, only Saudi Arabia has the ability to raise oil and gas production. Europe cannot turn to Russia anymore, and nor can they reliably turn to the U.S., where fracked shale gas has been a total failure. In a global climate of recession and inflation, we see no hesitation to protect energy deliveries.
Analysts say that the West is calling in their longtime support of brutal absolute monarchies and dictatorships in the Middle East, demanding that they direct their oil and gas supplies towards Europe amid the unrest in Ukraine. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Up to a quarter of the EU's electricity demand is generated using gas. In some of the bloc's member states, it is higher. As less of it arrives from Russia, EU nations have agreed to reduce gas consumption by 15% until spring.
I think at the end, everybody understands that this sacrifice is necessary. We have to, and we will share the pain.
Many in the European Parliament say the pain is not being shared equally.
Only working class people are dying, but the EU has done nothing to stop us. And so many people in here are glad the war has taken place.
Within NATO, there is opposition to Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance. Within the EU, there is opposition to the bloc's foreign policy towards Russia. There are also tensions between the EU and the UK.
At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess.
It has been suggested that Russia wants Western allies to fall out.
Now is not the time for finger-pointing. We understand that they want to destroy, they want to divide, they want to split this solidarity and unity.
Critics say the West is responsible for the war in Ukraine because Russia's security concerns were ignored and even preyed upon. Experts suggest the conflict has highlighted the EU's weaknesses and has exposed the lack of energy infrastructure investment within the bloc.
That is why investing in grids, in interconnectors, in something as boring as pipelines, that matters.
Ordinary people in the EU are asking, how did we get to this point? There is a cost of living crisis and all sorts of security concerns. Analysts warn there will be political ramifications. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
South Korea will soon resume large-scale military exercises with the United States. Seoul's recently appointed foreign minister Wednesday met with the foreign press and explained the importance of the U.S. alliance in the drills.
We expect that the Ministry of National Defense will resume training to maintain the South Korea-U.S. combined defense capabilities so that South Korea's security can be maintained.
The South Korean envoy placed the responsibility for subsequent military tension on North Korea.
North Korea's nuclear and missile development and provocations are the most important causes of tension on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea recently resumed ballistic missile testing after a self-imposed moratorium aimed at negotiating a lifting of U.S.-led sanctions, which remain in effect. Meanwhile, South Korea's further developed and tested missile technology and deployed several advanced U.S. weapon systems, raising concern in Pyongyang.
The U.S. and its allies are increasing their military pressure on our republic. All this is raising serious concern that the ravages of the war 72 years ago could be repeated here. Our measures to build up national defense capabilities are the legitimate and righteous exercise of our sovereignty to defend our national security and territory against military threats.
South Korea said this year's drills will include 11 field exercises, amphibious operations, and an air carrier strike group. South Korean officials have said the joint military exercises with the U.S. will begin on August 22nd, and for the first time since 2018, include field training. As new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol pivots to a hardline approach to Pyongyang, inter-Korean ties appear destined for greater tension. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Another day, another railway strike, bringing half of Britain's rail network to a grinding halt. Organized by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, the 24-hour industrial action has seen more than 40,000 railway workers walk out in a row over job security and pay at a time of soaring inflation. Any hope of an 11th-hour settlement has now been all but dashed.
We're just outside one of the busiest train stations in London, where members of the RMT union have formed a picket line demanding a fair deal. And they're saying if there isn't a negotiated settlement soon, there will be more walkouts in the weeks ahead.
Those words echoed by the head of the RMT union, that industrial action is the way forward.
I can't think of a way at the moment because we've been negotiating for 2 years. But it would be interesting if me and Grant Shapps went head to head. We could see how we got on with that, if that's not too flippant.
Grant Shapps is the transport secretary. Under him, the rail network and the subway have seen billions of dollars in cuts and offered below-inflation pay rises, described by the strikers as paltry. As widespread as the disruption is support for the railway workers. Today, the strikers found Britain's shadow transport secretary joining the picket line in central London.
When Grant Shapps and Liz Truss come on the telly and say to you that it's someone else's fault, it's the striking rail workers' fault that this dispute is happening, what a load of nonsense. The Trade Union Congress had a legal opinion just a few weeks ago that showed definitively that it is the government who are agitating for this dispute. And it needs to be resolved. It needs to be resolved fairly and justly and quickly for the sake of the travelling public.
The travellers, too, want the dispute resolved quickly.
But I love the railway. I love to travel by train. I want to keep doing it. And I don't want to keep thinking, oh, God, is it going to be, you know, unreliable?
Well, I totally get why they're striking. Obviously, it's an inconvenience for me, but I'm willing to make an exception.
There are more railway walkouts planned for the coming weeks. There are also reports of unrest among teaching staff and National Health Service employees. More disquiet is on the horizon as Britain awaits a new prime minister. Saeed Purza, London.
Dismissed us and it has cost taxpayers 70.
After the warm-up bouts of debates featuring multiple leadership candidates, it was time for the final two to square off in a live televised debate. The head-to-head was the first opportunity viewers, including the estimated 170,000 members of the Conservative Party eligible to vote in the leadership race, could see Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary, face off against former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Each wasted little time attacking each other's records and credentials and clashed heavily on their individual taxation plans to bring the country out of its worst cost of living crisis in generations.
We are an outlier. Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away so quickly that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work, and that hard-working taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
Hang on, Faisal. You just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
I'm sorry, this is scaremongering. Canada actually has project fear.
The candidates vying for the country's top job have not shied away from going after each other's political juggler. Some of the exchanges have been brutal, with the former chancellor accused of talking down to his political rival, while Liz Truss has honed in on Rishi Sunak's immense wealth. Now, Tory grandees are fearful that whoever wins this vote, it's actually the Tory party with all of this mudslinging that will be the eventual loser. Former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone has been keenly observing the leadership race. Polls have Rishi Sunak trailing Liz Truss amongst rank-and-file Tory members, and with ballot papers being sent out in early August, both candidates want to build momentum. The results of the leadership ballot will be revealed on September the 5th, still years ahead of a general election that will see the nation have the final say. Amina Taylor, London.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been raided once again by Palestine supporters, who claim to have inflicted significant damage on the property. The building belonging to UAV Engines was hit last Sunday as part of a wider campaign by Palestine Action activists to harass and hamper the activities of the international arms firm Elbit Systems.
Palestine Action claim that their latest direct action was in retaliation to Israeli regime attacks on the Palestinian city of Nablus in the West Bank on Sunday morning, killing at least two Palestinians and injuring many more. The group also vows that as long as Israeli aggression against Palestine continues, so will their campaign, targeting not just Israeli arms manufacturers in the UK, but also their partners as well.
Following Sunday's action, supporters gathered to protest outside UAV's gates in solidarity with the activists who were detained following the direct action.
The drone parts that are made here are used, are tested on the captive population of Gaza. We know that these drones have killed people, and we're here today to stop the arms trade overall, but specifically against Elbit.
Palestine Action have always said if you continue with this violence against the Palestinian people, then we will retaliate, we will resist, we will come back, we will shut down your factories.
The attack by Israel on Nablus is a common occurrence across occupied Palestine. The lack of action by Western powers to rein in Israeli aggression has inspired more aggressive activism. Palestine Action say their relentless raids have successfully forced the closure of two Elbit sites in London and Oldham. A spokesperson for Elbit acknowledged the incident, claiming it was an attack by a violent group. Although no one was harmed during the raid, Palestine Action's sites remain squarely fixed on UAV engines, so locals can expect more of the same scenes going forward. Robert Carter, Shenstone.
In the limelight.
There must immediately be a settlement freeze in accordance with international law and resolutions to preserve the right of the Palestinian people to their independent state, said one Palestinian official. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After Visit, Palestinians Say Biden Presidency is like the Trump years with a smile. Here's the story. Palestinians offered an assessment of U.S. President Joe Biden's policy agenda and track record thus far in the wake of his brief visit to the occupied Palestinian territories recently, with one official describing the administration as like the Trump years with a smile. Biden's trips to East Al-Quds and Beit Lahm recently were met with protests from right groups and ordinary Palestinians who decried the administration's refusal to break substantively from its predecessors and condemned the Zionist regime's deadly military aggression and unlawful occupation of Palestinian land. During his visit, Biden met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, but did not criticize Israel for expanding settlements, some of which resemble sprawling suburbs in occupied territory that the Palestinians want for a future state, the Associated Press reports. while giving lip service to a two-state solution and expressing his commitment to bringing Palestinians closer together, Biden said that the ground is not ripe at this moment to restart negotiations. Recently, Mohammad Shataya, Prime Minister of the Palestinian National Authority,